Now, the big read.
The poets light but lamps, themselves go out. The wicks they stimulate, if vital light, in here as do the suns, each age a lens disseminating their circumference.
That was poet Mary Jo Salter reading Emily Dickinson's The Poet's Light But Lamps. Welcome to The Big Read, a program created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. The largest reading program in American history, The Big Read is designed to unite communities through great literature. Now, poet and president of the Poetry Foundation, John Barr, discusses Emily Dickinson. It's part of our American Literary Landmark series, a celebration of the nation's great poets and the historic houses that inform their work. Here's John Barr.
Welcome to American Literary Landmarks. Today, we're going to talk about Emily Dickinson. From her private room in the town of Amherst, Emily Dickinson created an original body of poetry unlike anything else in American literature. Her poems, sometimes as cryptic as puzzles, are filled with surprising syntax, unexpected metaphors, and sublime paradoxes that, quote, tell the truth, but tell it slant, unquote. Emily Dickinson was born on December 10, 1830, in the family home called The Homestead on Main Street in Amherst, Massachusetts. Emily was the second child in the family. Her brother, Austin, was a year and a half older, and her sister, Lavinia, was born a few years later in 1833. Her father, Edward, was a prosperous, civic-minded attorney who had been educated at Amherst and Yale. He served in the Massachusetts state legislature and was even a representative in the U.S. Congress for one term. Emily's mother and namesake, Emily Norcross Dickinson, maintained a busy household at the homestead, raised the children, and supported the lives of her husband and family. Of her parents, Dickinson wrote, "My mother does not care for thought, and father, too busy with his briefs, to notice what we do. He buys me many books, but begs me not to read them, because he fears they joggle the mind." Emily's childhood was similar to many young girls of the age. Her schooling, however, was far superior to what most young women received in the 19th century. She studied at Amherst Academy, an excellent secondary school, for 7 years before entering Mount Holyoke Female Seminary for a year. That was the longest time Emily ever spent away from family and friends. We don't know why she left the seminary after so short a time, but whatever the reason, Emily came back to live with her family for good. In those days, young, unmarried women were expected to take over the family's domestic duties, and this was no exception for Emily. Quote, "God keep me from what they call households," unquote, she wrote to a friend. Being the daughter of a prominent family, she would be expected to receive visitors and visit others on behalf of her family. That was a task neither she nor her mother enjoyed, and Emily declined as often as possible. When she was in her early 20s, Dickinson became serious about her writing. Her output was daunting and creative, her discipline rigorous. In letters to her brother, she mentions her ambition, quote, "I have dared to do strange things, bold things," unquote. Since this spirit differed so from the roles expected of women in the era, she couched her desires in the language of temptation, quote, "I have heeded beautiful tempters," unquote. Every great poet writes in a voice that is unmistakably his or hers. When we hear the high, tragic diction of Homer or Yeats, or the urgent but colloquial voice of Dante, who speaks to us in the Inferno as if we saw him on the street just yesterday, or the boisterous, almost overly familiar diction of Walt Whitman, We don't need to know the poet's name to know who it is speaking. Emily Dickinson's voice is equally unmistakable. We hear it as if it is coming from the next room. It is a contemporary voice, quiet, contemplative, but also passionate. In fact, the voice is slyly provocative. It never plays into our expectations. Rather, it uses the unexpected as a principal conversational tactic. The rhymes are there, so we know it's a poem, but they are there sparingly. The rhythms are there as well, but they are not mechanical like a metronome. Her poems wear form, but they wear it lightly. They suffer form, but are not beholden to it. Take, for example, her poem, "There is no frigate like a book."
There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away, nor any coursers like a page of prancing poetry. This traverse may the poorest take without oppress of toll. How frugal is the chariot that bears the human soul.
This poem by Emily Dickinson allows us to watch a great poet at work. It's a poem many Americans have seen or heard, even if they don't read poetry or are not sure who wrote it. As much as any single poem, it is out there in American culture. This little poem has 8 lines, and it rhymes with every other line. So the rhymes would be away, poetry, and toll, soul. There are no difficult words in the poem. They come out of our everyday speech. But the words themselves are noticeably energetic. In that first line, it's not a sailing ship, but a frigate, a distinct word for a specific kind of sailing ship. And it's not just any carriage horses, but coursers. We know it's a poem we're hearing, and not prose, because the lines are metrical. They have a recurrent iambic beat. In a nice touch, those first rhymes do not close down their lines at the end. The word away is just the open vowel sound you want to express in terms of sound the open-ended possibilities of travel. Like any good poem, the sound in the line should reinforce the thought in the lines. On a first hearing, the poem has the tidy feel of an epigram, with that strong closing rhyme of toll and soul. And indeed, the argument of the poem seems straightforward, or at least it does for the first 4 lines.
There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away, nor any coursers like a page of prancing poetry.
The voice in those lines is buoyant and confident as it asserts the power of books to take us lands away. For Emily Dickinson, who lived from birth to death in Amherst, Massachusetts, reading was world travel and something she did from childhood on. So far, so good. But in the second 4 lines of the poem, things get complicated. The poem becomes Dickinsonian.
This traverse may the poorest take without oppress of toll. How frugal is the chariot that bears the human soul.
It may take a couple of readings, but we can figure out what the poet wants us to understand. Reading a book is the kind of travel even the poorest of us can undertake without suffering the expenses of physical travel. But why traverse? Travel is the obvious word, and scans just as well as traverse. We could say, this travel may the poorest take without oppressive toll. But the word traverse resonates differently. Traverse is what planets do in the night sky. And where travel carries the thought of leaving home, going out somewhere to have an adventure and coming back again, traverse does not necessarily include the return trip. Traverse can be a journey from one place or state of being to another without the thought of coming home. Suddenly, the poem is talking about something more than armchair travel.
How frugal is the chariot that bears the human soul?
The closing lines of this poem leave us watching the transit of the human soul through life. A Dickinson poem never gives us pat answers. Her individualism is characteristic of transcendentalists, a movement in the mid-19th century whose geographic center, Concord, Massachusetts, was not far from her home. Many of its proponents were visitors to the homestead, including Ralph Waldo Emerson, whom Dickinson read avidly. Emily Dickinson lived in tumultuous times. Her lifetime encompassed the Civil War, as well as successive waves of religious awakening that swept America in the 19th century. Inspired by the Concord Transcendentalists, she challenged the existing orthodoxy of poetry and religious beliefs. The narrators of her poems are confident, first-person speakers who proclaim the power of the individual conscience rather than the dogma of organized religions. Emily's response to organized religion was to keep her distance, although in her poetry she is personally and deeply concerned with the questions that religions address. In her painful shyness, which later in life became a phobia, she declined to go to church in a small town where everybody went to church. Here is her answer to the social pressures that she must have felt.
"Some keep the Sabbath going to church. I keep it staying at home, with a bobolink for a chorister and an orchard for a dome. Some keep the Sabbath in surplice. I just wear my wings. And instead of tolling the bell for church, our little sexton sings. God preaches, a noted clergyman, and the sermon is never long. So instead of getting to heaven at last, I'm going all along."
Dickinson was a locally renowned gardener, and that comes into the first stanza, with a bobolink for a chorister and an orchard for a poem. Dickinson's high wit is also at work in the poem. "Some keep the Sabbath in surplice, I just wear my wings." Do those wings make her another bobolink in the orchard? Or is she teasing tongue-in-cheek that she is an angel and therefore above the fallen mortals in town who do need to go to church? The final stanza of the poem borders on the wickedly funny. She calls God a noted clergyman whose sermon is never long, unlike the ones in church. The poem ends with what turns out to be a tightly reasoned argument on why God is better found in a garden than in church. "So instead of getting to heaven at last, I'm going all along." Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman were contemporaries, but they never met. A comment in one of her letters suggests that Emily was aware of Whitman's book Leaves of Grass and did not approve of it. Whitman was unaware of Emily Dickinson, but then so was everybody else. If one imagines the two together on a stage, I fear that Emily Dickinson would have seemed quite diminutive, even elfin, compared to the barbarian standing next to her. Her intimate voice was not for big theaters, whereas Walt addressed the universe with a capital U when he spoke. Where he declaimed, she whispered. But in the matter of literary reputations, forever is a long time. Today, the two stand with equal stature as the father and mother of the American poetry that followed. Emily Dickinson never married. Uncomfortable with large crowds, even the august assemblies in church and school eventually grew to be too much. By the end of her 20s and for the rest of her life, she had withdrawn from contact with all but immediate friends and family. But the intensity and passion inside of her did not abate. They found their outlet in the poems, sometimes written at the rate of one per day, and in her correspondence. We know from a few of the letters that she drafted that Emily held a fierce attachment, both emotional and physical, for an unidentified man addressed in her letters only as Master. Like the woman and the man in Shakespeare's sonnets, the Master in Emily Dickinson's poem is not known and may never be. He appears again, this time as Señor, in this beautiful love poem.
"The moon is distant from the sea, and yet with amber hands she leads him, docile as a boy, along appointed sands. He never misses a degree. Obedient to her eye, he comes just so far toward the town, just so far goes away. O Signor, thine the amber hand, and mine the distant sea. Obedient to the least command, thine eye impose on me.
As the moon exerts its nightly gravitational pull on the ocean tides of a coastal town, so does the master exert his attraction on Emily, and she responds like the tide, precisely, exactly obedient to its command. In 1874, her father passed away and her mother's death followed in 1882. That same year, her friend, Judge Otis Phillips Lord, proposed to her. Dickinson declined and chose to remain at the family home. She became ill in 1883 and remained in poor health until her death on May 15, 1886, at the age of 55. Only a handful of poems, fewer than a dozen, were published during Emily Dickinson's lifetime, and some of these may have been without her knowledge or consent. Ironically, that anonymity has made Emily Dickinson the patron saint, or should I say matron saint, of all yet-to-be or perhaps never-to-be published poets. Dickinson had a complex relationship to fame. She understood well the worth of her poetry, but that knowledge struggled against her inability to promote or even to present her poems to editors and to the public. That self-enforced self-effacement makes her the special friend of poets who write privately or who have an aversion to self-promotion. Quote, "I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too?" Unquote. After her death, relatives discovered 40 hand-bound volumes totaling almost 1,800 poems. 4 years later, the first volume of her poetry was published and found an immediate audience with the reading public. It sold through 6 printings in 6 months, and 11 editions were printed in less than 2 years. Her work has been in print ever since. Her example permits unknown poets to believe in their work in spite of the world's neglect and to live in hope. Emily Dickinson's impact is no less powerful with today's most published poets. She is the only modern poet I know of to occasion an anthology, not of poems by her, but of poems addressed to her or inspired by her from other poets. Emily Dickinson could not have died feeling like a success, but the sustained influence of her original thought, inventive language, and unusual meter and rhyme helped to change the course of American literature.
Come slowly, Eden. Lips unused to thee, bashful, sip thy jessamines, as the fainting bee, reaching late his flower, round her chamber hums, counts his nectars, enters, and is lost in balms.
One mark of great poets is that they have something to tell us at each stage of our life. We never outgrow them. The poems of William Butler Yeats, who became a literary hero to me when I was 19, have continued to illuminate each decade of my life as I grew up and grew older. The same is certainly true of Emily Dickinson. She's the older friend a lovesick teenager needs to hear. And when a death in the family comes upon us, she is there as the most precise poet on grief in the English language. For the poet that lives in many of us, the writer we would like to be, she articulates the mistrust of fame and the anguish of anonymity. If you're unfamiliar with the work of Emily Dickinson, read, or better listen to, these poems as if you were listening to a close friend, someone you have known since childhood, from whom there are no secrets, who is clear-headed, inquisitive, passionate, and yes, at times difficult, as close friends can be. But this is a friend who has greatness of mind. Watching that remarkable intelligence at work in the poems, we can better make our own approaches to these unanswerable questions. Does life continue after death? And if not, is love perhaps the only human response to the fact of our mortality? She offers no glib or easy answers, but she wonders about them aloud as compellingly as any poet I know.
Of glory, not a beam is left but her eternal house. The asterisk is for the dead, the living for the stars.
Thanks for joining The Big Read. The program was created by the National Endowment for the Arts in partnership with the Institute of Museum and Library Services. This introduction to the poetry of Emily Dickinson has been made possible in part with support from the Poetry Foundation. It was written and narrated by John Barr. Mary Jo Salter read the poetry of Emily Dickinson. The assistant producers were Adam Campy, Liz Mahaffey, and Pepper Smith. Excerpts from Ludwig van Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 28 in A Major, performed by Seymour Lipkin, used courtesy of Newport Classic Limited. Excerpts from the following compositions used courtesy of Naxos of America, Incorporated. Johann Sebastian Bach's Cello Suite No. 4 in E-flat Major and Cello Suite No. 6 in D Major, performed by Alexander Rudin. Ludwig van Beethoven's String Quartets No. 2 in G Major, No. 3 in D Major, and No. 8 in A Minor, all performed by the Kodály Quartet. Beethoven's Violin Sonatas No. 5 in F Major and No. 9 in A Major, performed by Yano Yando and Takako Nishizaki. Edward McDowell's To a Wild Rose and To a Water Lily from Woodland Sketches, To the Sea and From a Wandering Iceberg from Sea Pieces, and An Old Garden and With Sweet Lavender from New England Idols, all performed by James Barbagallo. Thanks to Ted Libby and Erica Koss, with a special thanks to Jane Wald, Executive Director of the Emily Dickinson Museum. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm the Executive Producer, Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening. For more information about The Big Read, go to www.neabigread.org. That's www.neabigread.org.